Thank you for coming to my talk today. My name is Jared Nemitz, and I will be presenting some research that we've done on trying to determine the critical soil phosphorus level to initially establish turf grass, Kentucky bluegrass, and tall fescue on a calcareous subsoil. The problem that we're having is that the public and the regulatory communities in the world, in the United States, are perceiving turf grass to be a major contributor to environmental contamination. We're seeing it on the state, the local, the townships, and federal levels pursuing fertilizer bans, especially phosphorus, due to its highest percentage of algal available P, which can cause eutrophication or algal growth on water bodies. We see this perception in ads such as the one on the left, green lawns, clean lakes, the connection between lawn care and water quality. And I mean, this picture says a thousand words, does it not? Where if a homeowner's going to go out and we tell a homeowner, go apply fertilizer, you're applying it to a water body. And that's the kind of perception that we're battling in our industry. However, we know from research that research has documented that contamination from a properly maintained turf or a good turf stand, there's really the loss and sediment losses and runoff and nutrient losses is very negligible. It's much lower than when you have bare soil. So the purpose of this research was really to try to figure out how to get these turf grasses or Kentucky bluegrass and tall fescue to rapidly establish on this bad subsoil in order to decrease the chance of a sediment and nutrient losses. However, the problem that we are also running into is in the Midwest and Indiana, where I'm from, a common thing during construction is to, during the building of basements, the removal of that subsoil and placing it on the top of that nutrient-rich topsoil. So the topsoil that would be great for establishment of turf grass, you know, turf grass guy like me would love to be able to establish on that type of soil, is now buried by 6 to 12 inches or more of this calcareous, low phosphorus, low organic matter subsoil, making it very difficult to establish turf grass. So this part of my research project was to really determine, the first thing was determine that critical soil phosphorus level in order to rapidly establish Kentucky bluegrass and turf-type tall fescue on this subsoil. The second part of this was we wanted to look at the caveat of the endophyte portion of this. What response would the endophyte have on that tall fescue during this establishment? So the first thing that we wanted to do was find a typical construction site, which we did, and found a subsoil that really met our requirements for this project. And this one had marginally low phosphorus, high calcium, and low organic matter. So it fit our requirements, and this was the type of subsoil that we were going to use for this project. So we took that subsoil from the construction site, and we brought it in, and we incubated it with 7 levels of phosphorus using monocalcium phosphate. And we did this for 2 weeks, and we raised the soil levels from each of those treatments from 12 to 30, a range from 12 to 30 milligrams of phosphorus per kilogram. So we took the soil and we put it in the greenhouse and we seeded it with tall fescue and Kentucky bluegrass at 97 and 488 kilograms per hectare, respectively. And we, to achieve the tall fescue without endophyte, we heated that seed at 50 degrees Celsius for 2 weeks. We set up the experiment as a randomized complete block design using SAS general linear models to analyze the data, as well as try to use a linear plateau when the data would allow. When the pots were in the greenhouse, we had watering trays underneath each pot to maintain adequate soil moisture. We kept the watering trays filled 3 to 5 times per week, as well as added an average of 150 milliliters of water to the pot throughout a growing week. And throughout the study, nitrogen was not a limiting nutrient, and we applied 17.1 kilograms per hectare on a biweekly basis. We took a lot of different data off of this study, But the three different data sets that I will present today due to time is percent turf cover, dry matter yield, and leaf tissue phosphorus. First, percent cover was taken using digital image analysis. We did this on a weekly basis by using a light box and taking a picture of each pot and running it through this software program called SigmaScan Pro, which allowed us to highlight the green pixels and get a pretty good idea or an accurate measurement of how much turf grass cover or density was actually there. This figure represents the percent cover for the species that was used during this study. The y-axis was the percent cover on a 0 to 100% basis, and the x-axis represents the days after seeding from 28 to 77 days. The first and Kentucky bluegrass was the green bars, followed by the turf type tall fescue without endophyte, the red bars, and the black bars represent the turf type tall fescue with endophyte. The first thing that we did notice was that there were substantial differences between the species. The Kentucky bluegrass struggled mightily to establish at the onset of this study. We saw that, it took many weeks, almost a month and a half, to even get to 40% cover, which is unacceptable due to the prolonging of bare soil there, which could lead to sediment loss and nutrient losses. And we saw that the tall fescue established much quicker on this type of subsoil, and the tall fescue with endophyte was much quicker to establish with the tall fescue without endophyte. So that's very important when we're looking at what's the best species to have to decrease the chances of runoff. Here's an example of a picture taken 28 days after seeding, comparing the tall fescue with endophyte to the tall fescue without endophyte, and you can see that there was a substantial difference in cover between the two pots. This figure represents the total dry matter yield taken throughout this whole study for Kentucky bluegrass, and the x-axis represents the soil P level that was changed by the additions of phosphorus to the soil. And throughout our study, we didn't see the clear-cut, linear plateau models that is very common with trying to find the critical phosphorus levels or other nutrients. Some of the data met. It wasn't as clean as we had liked, but here we have the total dry matter yield for Kentucky bluegrass, and we can see that we did have a maximizing dry matter yield with the soil P level of 25 to 30 milligrams of phosphorus per kilogram. So changing that soil level to that 25 to 30 range maximized the dry matter yield for Kentucky bluegrass. Here we can see this is the same table. Now it's representing tall fescue, and it's not at the end of the study, but it is now 63 days after seeding, so a week before the end of the study. But that is because tall fescue was not as sensitive to these phosphorus treatments as the Kentucky bluegrass was. So we didn't see these the linear model or that linear plateau like we did with the Kentucky bluegrass. But here we see that dry matter yield was maximized with the soil phosphorus levels of 30 to 35 milligrams of phosphorus per kilogram for the tall fescue. Here is the total dry matter yield, same type of information, except now we're looking at the top line is the tall fescue with endophyte, the second line is tall fescue without endophyte, and the third or bottom line is the Kentucky bluegrass. So you can see how the Kentucky bluegrass had a much better response curve compared to the tall fescue. The tall fescue was just able to overcome the challenges of this subsoil much better than the Kentucky bluegrass was. But once again, we can see with the Kentucky bluegrass, that addition of that 45 to 75, the two higher treatments, did result in the maximization of the dry matter yield. This table represents the leaf tissue phosphorus concentrations that we analyzed on the Kentucky bluegrass. The harvest periods 1, 2, and 3 represents a conglomeration of harvest periods. Harvest period 1 represents all the harvest dates up to 21 days after seeding. Harvest period 2 represents all of the harvest periods from 21 to 63 days after seeding. And the last one represents all of the remaining harvest that we removed up to the end of the study. And I've highlighted the numbers based on some of the previous research on Kentucky bluegrass, where the blue represents adequate to high amounts of phosphorus in the leaf tissue. The critical was orange, and red is deficient, where the phosphorus was deficient in the leaf tissue. The first thing we did see was that the increased amounts of phosphorus applied to the soil did result in an increased amounts of leaf tissue phosphorus within the tissue as we move from 0 to 75. And the next thing we did see was that on the first rating date, or the first analysis date, we did see that from all the treatments that had 9 to 75 milligrams of phosphorus added did result in adequate amounts of phosphorus in the leaf tissue, followed by the second and third, where only the 45 and 75 resulted in adequate levels of phosphorus in the leaf tissue. This could be because initially at establishment, if you remember from the percent cover, there just wasn't a whole lot of leaf tissue there. So therefore, there could be a higher concentration of phosphorus in the leaf tissue due to the lower amounts of dry matter yield being removed, and why we had more leaf tissue phosphorus at the beginning compared to the second and third harvest period dates. This is the same data just representing the tall fescue, and we saw the same trends. The increased amounts of phosphorus did have an effect on the increased amounts of leaf tissue phosphorus throughout the harvest periods, but we did see that the higher two treatments, the 45 and the 75 additions to the soil, resulted in the higher amounts of leaf tissue phosphorus. And the leaf tissue phosphorus for tall fescue was lower than the Kentucky bluegrass, probably due to the much higher amounts of clippings that were being removed from the tall fescue plots compared to the Kentucky bluegrass. And interestingly, we did see a difference in the tall fescue with and without endophytes. It could be due to the dry matter yield, as I've talked about. The tall fescue without endophytes resulted in higher amounts of leaf tissue phosphorus on two of the three harvest period dates, higher than the tall fescue with endophytes. This study was a challenge in that it wasn't as clear-cut as we had thought. I was really expecting nice linear or nice quadratic plateaus throughout on all my data points or all my dates, and it just wasn't as cut and dry as that. We had to use GLM quite a bit to try to analyze the data, and establishing this turf grass on this type of subsoil was difficult. The Kentucky bluegrass just did not react well to it. It took almost a month to even get to 20% percent cover, which is unacceptable when you're talking about trying to reduce sediment losses from lawns during establishment. Planting tall fescue did result in the quickest establishment compared to Kentucky bluegrass. I mean, we saw that in all the measurements that we did take. Endophyte. We weren't expecting the endophyte to be such a strong factor in this study. It was actually kind of a last-minute addition to this study, but I'm really glad that we did it, and that we found that the endophyte infection in tall fescue really had a strong influence throughout all the study and all the measurements that we did take. So further research on this type of subsoil with the benefits of endophyte is probably necessary. The Kentucky bluegrass appears to be more sensitive to the low phosphorus soil than tall fescue. Tall fescue seemed to just overcome that type of soil, that compacting soil, and then the challenges that soil presented just seemed to do much, appear to be more sensitive to the low phosphorus than the tall fescue did. Throughout the study, we found that the two higher additions of phosphorus to the soil, raising the levels from 12 to 22 to 30 milligrams of phosphorus really maximized the tall fescue and Kentucky bluegrass establishment. Although Kentucky bluegrass never reached an ex- was never acceptable to me throughout this study, I feel that the 22 to 30 mark was fine for the tall fescue, but further research needs to be done on Kentucky bluegrass to determine what that level is, because obviously the amount that we put down was not enough for Kentucky bluegrass to establish rapidly. So the presence of endophytes once again contributed greatly to the adaptability and the persistence of the tall fescue during this study. And further research needs to be done on the endophytes with this, looking at the rooting characteristics. Why was the tall fescue so much better with endophytes? Was it, did it have a better root system? It was a healthier plant throughout the study, so that would lead me to believe that there was probably some healthier root systems able to get to the phosphorus that was there much easier than the tall fescue without, or the Kentucky bluegrass. With that, I'd just like to thank the MRTF for supporting the research, and I'm sure I have some time, so I have any questions.
Are any questions?
Yes.
Do you know whether the temperatures that you incubated the endophyte infected tall fescue seed with would have had any impact on the seedling germination or seedling vigor of the tall fescue? 50 C seems like a very extreme temperature regime. And I've done some seed longevity testing and seen seed dying within 3 to 6 weeks at the 95 degree Fahrenheit temperature, which is less than. Some of that depends on the humidity, but did you have any way of evaluating whether that was impacting the seedling viability or the seed viability?
During this study, we did not look at that, but in a previous study, getting ready for this, we did do a germination test with that seed, and we found that there really wasn't a difference in the germination time or the viability long term. It was only a few weeks, and I did not look at it 6 to 9 weeks, but we did try to do a preliminary study to try to make sure that temperature degrees that we heated the seed at did not harm the germination or the longevity of the seed.
This is piggybacking on a prior magnitude study where we actually did a 7-day germination test. This is the ragdoll test, if you will. There was no difference between the heated seed and the unheated seed. I see like 90%.
Do you know what your relative humidity was?
Do not.
His incubation period?
Yeah. Or that you were treating the tall fescue seed?
It was a forced air dry oven, so it applied pretty well. We also had done some things in terms of bottling up how much endophyte was there. If we could be